Chapter 12. Some Objections Answered. We must fight against the spirit of unconscious cruelty with which we treat the animals. Animals suffer as much as we do. It is our duty to make the whole world recognize it. Albert Schweitzer. Animals of the world exist for their own reasons. They were not made for humans any more than blacks were made for whites or women for men. Alice Walker. And now a third, a brazen people rise, unlike the former, men of monstrous size. On the crude flesh of beasts they feed alone, savage their nature and their hearts of stone. Hesiod, 8th century BCE. Nurturing Objections. The ideas presented in this book, though not complicated or particularly difficult to understand, have long been invisible and almost impossible to articulate because they directly contradict the hidden assumptions of our herding culture. Their ramifications, if contemplated, discussed, and acted upon, are enormously subversive to the status quo. Even other subversive social theories that are rarely seen in schools or the media, such as Marxism, don't begin to address the deeper issue we are discussing, the mentality of domination and exclusion that necessarily flows from commodifying animals and eating animal foods, and that gives rise to competition, repression of the feminine principle, and the exploitation of the lower classes by the wealthier cattle, capital-owning classes. Marx's Workers of the World Unite never questioned the underlying ethic of dominating animals and nature, and hence was not truly revolutionary. It operated within the human supremacist framework and never challenged the mentality that sees living beings as commodities. Veganism is a call for us to unite in seeing that as long as we oppress other living beings, we will inevitably create and live in a culture of oppression. Class struggle is a result of the herding culture's mentality of domination and exclusion, and is just part of the misery that is inevitably connected with eating animal foods. The vegan commitment to consciously minimize our cruelty to all animals is so revolutionary in its implications that it is often summarily dismissed because it triggers cognitive dissonance and deep anxiety. We have been so ingrained with the herding mentality since birth that even those of us who consider ourselves to be quite progressive aren't typically prepared to question the exploitation of animals and humans that we cause by our food choices. Like a ball being held underwater, our natural compassion wants to come bobbing up to the surface, so we must continually work to keep it repressed. The way we keep the ball of kindness and intelligence submerged is not only by practicing disconnecting, but also by the practice of nurturing some culturally induced objections to eating a plant-based diet, which we repeat to ourselves if the ball starts rising. Animals as ethically trivial. One of these basic objections is that compassion for animals gives them more importance than they merit. With this objection, the dominant herding paradigm trivializes animals, scoffing at vegans for caring about them while their fellow human beings suffer from poverty, the breakdown of the family, war, drug addiction, terrorism, pollution, and so forth. This objection is merely a restatement of the herding culture's fundamental supremacist orientation that legitimizes the domination of animals. It is based in an attitude that animals don't matter, that their suffering at our hands is not an issue, and that they are somehow superfluous or expendable. If we can get our minds and hearts somehow outside the box constructed by our culturally defining core practice of enslaving and killing animals for food, which traps our thinking and feeling within the narrow confines of the dominator herding mentality, we will begin to see, feel, and understand what animals actually are. We will see that, like us, animals are expressions of infinite universal love intelligence, that, like us, they yearn for satisfaction of their drives and desires and avoid pain and suffering, that, like us, they are profoundly mysterious. If we've learned anything at all about animals, it is that we can in no way make them fit into the categories of our limited understanding. When we look at animals in nature, it is possible to see competition, struggle, and violence, as many scientists are trained to do. And yet it is also possible to see cooperation and mutual aid, as Kropotkin and other scientists have discovered. Further, it is possible to see celebration, joy, humor, love, caring, and the wondrous interplay and expression of an absolutely infinite complexity of life forms. There is a deep truth in the old saying that we see things not as they are, but as we are. We have not yet begun to scratch the surface of understanding animals. How can we know what it is to swim as whales, at home in the ocean depths and migrating thousands of miles, speaking in underwater songs and breathing together in conscious harmony, or to fly in a flock of sandpipers, whirling in an effortless synchronicity, 50 birds as one, or to burrow as prairie dogs, creating complex underground communities with virtually endless chambers, passageways, and interactions. Our knowledge and understanding of non-human animals is polluted, far more than we acknowledge, by our belief in our own superiority, our unrecognized cultural programming, and our separation from nature. Our theories about animals will be seen in the future as quaint balderdash, as we now view the medieval theories of healing through bleeding and leeches and of an earth-centered solar system. Our understanding is so contaminated by our mentality of objectification that we are killing off animals and destroying species and natural communities at a rate unparalleled in history. When we look deeply, we see that understanding brings and awakens love, and that love brings and awakens understanding. If our so-called understanding of animals does not ignite within us a loving urge to allow them to fulfill their lives and purposes, to honor, respect, and appreciate them, then it is not true understanding. Our science is in many ways incapable of this authentic understanding. And because it is also often a vehicle of corporate power, it is best not to rely on it too heavily in our quest for wisdom or healing. The myth of human predation. A second objection to veganism raised by the herding culture is that eating animal foods must be natural and right because we've been doing it for such a long time. The first response to this objection is to question its basic validity. We know as individuals that it is often counterproductive and crippling if we carry into adulthood the same strategies and beliefs we used as children. The fact that we've been doing something a long time hardly makes it right or appropriate. The same defense of human slavery was used here in the 19th century. How will we progress or evolve if we continue to justify outmoded behavior and obsolete beliefs by giving them validity they don't deserve? War, genocide, murder, rape, and human exploitation have been going on a long time as well, but we would never dare to use their longevity to justify them. that we would do so to justify the enslavement, exploitation, murder, rape, and extinction of animals is telling, but completely specious. It undermines our healthy yearning to grow in wisdom and to strive to build a society that is more free, peaceful, and sustainable. The second response to this objection is to question its veracity. What is a, quote, long time? The 10,000 years we've been herding and commodifying animals and the 20 to 60,000 years we've been hunting large animals are very short compared to the 300,000 years Homo sapiens has been here and the 7 to 10 million years that hominids have been here. Our closest living relatives, supposedly sharing 95 to 90% of our DNA, are gorillas, bonobos, and chimpanzees. The powerful and gentle gorillas eat a totally plant-based diet, as do bonobos, and chimpanzees eat a primarily plant-based diet. Our own ancient forebears were probably similar given our physiology, and according to fossil evidence of such early humans as Australopithecus, plant foods made up virtually all of their diet. The problem has been that our culture has fostered its own, quote, man the predator mythology based on and justifying our eating of animals, propagating the erroneous notion that, as Swiss zoologist C. Gugisberg wrote in 1970, quote, man has been a predator and ruthless killer for as long as he has existed, end quote. This same lie that, quote, man is a beast of prey, end quote, Oswald Spengler, has been repeated so much that we believe it and perpetuate it. Jim Mason explains, quote, deeply ingrained in our culture, then, are some very strong values that favor killing and consuming animals for food. How could they not have affected studies of human diet, food collection, and evolution? Surely our own culture's meat-eater values have been a factor in the exaggeration of the hunter role in human evolution, in the same way that its patriarchal values have been a factor in the exaggeration of the male role in evolution. Indeed, both of these cultural biases worked well together in promoting the man the mighty hunter model of human evolution. Hunting as men's work was highly valued by anthropology's mostly male investigators, and since hunting provided meat, it was doubly valued by meat-eating investigators. The hunter creation myth also helps a meat-eating society with a very troublesome problem. People generally are more than a little uncomfortable with killing animals for food. Most would probably not be willing to kill an animal themselves, except in dire circumstances. Even northern hunting peoples surrounded their hunting and butchering activities with ritual, much of it, as we shall see, to ease anxiety and discomfort. End quote. Anthropologists Donna Hart and Robert W. Sussman, in their recent groundbreaking synthesis of fossil evidence in primatology, explain that early humans did not have teeth that could eat meat and were not predatory hunters. They argue that the views of, quote, man the hunter and of our ancestors as, quote, bloodthirsty brutes are based on three things, quote, perverted Western views of modern humans, the Christian concept of original sin, and just plain sloppy science, end quote. We must question our culture's underlying assumptions and understand how these assumptions perpetuate themselves. No one knows exactly why we humans began killing and eating animals. According to Plutarch, writing nearly 2,000 years ago, quote, the primitive people who first ate meat likely did so out of extreme privation. People in those days were reduced to eating mud, bark, grass sprouts, and roots. Finding acorns and buckeyes would have been cause for celebration. If these people could only speak to us today, they would undoubtedly tell us how fortunate we are to have such an abundance of delicious vegetable foods at our fingertips, and how fortunate that we can fill our stomachs without polluting ourselves with flesh. They would be perplexed by the lust that leads people to eat meat in these times of plenty, They would ask, "Don't you think the good earth can sustain you? Aren't you ashamed to mix the wholesome produce of the earth with blood and flesh?" End quote. Today, there are masses of conflicting theories as to why we began flesh-eating, and they are all to some degree warped by being products of the herding culture itself. Many attribute it partially to our early migrations out of the tropical and subtropical regions into the cooler, temperate regions where plant foods weren't so easily available. Many of the theories are skewed by the invisible assumptions of male researchers who assume that men have always dominated women, hunted large animals, and warred with each other. Even when these theories are shown to be inaccurate, they tend to live on because they fit nicely with the herding culture's overall paradigm, and they serve the interests of other writers who have similar erroneous theories. A good example is Peter Diadamo in his popular Eat Right for Your Type books, which encourage eating animal foods based on blood type. Diadamo claims that type O people are best suited to eating animal flesh because type O is allegedly the oldest blood type. His books are based on completely outdated anthropological research that postulated the earliest humans, allegedly blood type O, were more carnivorous. Diadamo ignores the more recent research that shows the early, quote, hunter-gatherers were much more gatherers than hunters. The mass culture, raised on the stereotype of macho cavemen dragging women around by the hair and eating mastodons for lunch, eagerly believes Diadamo because his books argue that most people, being of the older blood types, need meat and just won't do well on a vegan diet. The theory has obvious mass appeal since 40 to 60% of our population is blood type O, but is grossly inaccurate. There are many happy, healthy type O vegans, and blood type has nothing to do with the basic herbivore design of our bodies or with the cruelty inflicted on animals for food. Because it dovetails so well with our herding culture's basic view of reality, though, the books sell well and provide some of us with an erroneous justification to continue our omnivorous mealtime traditions. The same could be said for the high-protein and low-carbohydrate diets that are so predictably popular, as well as the high-iron or high-calcium diets that promote eating animal foods. It's well established that plant-based diets give us ample calcium, iron, and protein, without the damaging effects of the cruelty, adrenaline, cholesterol, saturated fat, and toxins endemic to animal foods. Confronted with the problems that characterize our herding culture, we are perhaps like the metaphorical man wounded by an arrow that the Buddha discussed with his students. He said that the man would be foolish if he tried to discover who shot the arrow, why he shot it, where he was when he shot it, and so forth, before having the arrow removed and the wound treated, lest he bleed to death attempting to get his questions answered. We, likewise, can all remove the arrow and treat the wound of eating animal foods right now. We don't need to know the whole history. We can easily see it is cruel and that it is unnecessary. Whatever people have done in the past, we are not obligated to imitate them if it is based on delusion. Perhaps in the past people thought they needed to enslave animals and people to survive and that the cruelty involved in it was somehow allowed them. It's obviously not necessary for us today, as we can plainly see by walking into any grocery store, and the sooner we can awaken from the thrall of the obsolete mythos that we are predatory by nature, the sooner we'll be able to evolve spiritually and discover and fulfill our purpose on this earth. We're in an auspicious position today because the industrialized nations of the world, which eat the highest percentage of animal foods and are generally in the north, have food distribution systems that bring plant-based foods to all their inhabitants, regardless of their climate and topography. Fruits, vegetables, grains, legumes, and even soy milk, tofu, tempeh, and so forth are available in markets everywhere. There are very few people today who must eat animal foods for geographic reasons. It is the height of irony that eating a diet based on animal foods, which are complicated, wasteful, cruel and expensive to produce, is seen as simple in our culture, and that eating a vegan diet based on plant foods, which are simple, efficient, inexpensive, and free of cruelty to produce, is seen as complicated and difficult. Nevertheless, the truth is slowly coming to light, and the pressures within the old paradigm are building as more of us refuse to see animals as objects to be eaten or used for our purposes. The justification of science. A third objection is that science uses animals in experiments, and if science, which has brought us the technological progress we value so highly, doesn't question dominating animals, who are we to do so? We can see, though, that scientific theories always reflect the fundamental orientation of the mainstream culture, and that science and culture echo and reproduce each other. As Thomas Kuhn demonstrated in his classic work, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, scientific paradigms, like cultural paradigms, resist change. The history of science shows not so much a gradual accumulation of objectively true knowledge, which can hardly be said to exist because of the way context determines meaning and truth, but a series of shifts in the discipline's underlying paradigms. Paradigms are the internal patterns through which we structure knowledge and experience and make sense of the world, and these paradigms are learned. In school, while we are learning content on the surface level, for example, facts and ideas about biology, history, or mathematics, we are also learning on a paradigmatic level through the form of the educational process itself. It is invisible learning, conveyed through educational structures like giving tests, having students compete with each other, dividing knowledge into discrete subjects, using animals for dissection, giving teachers authority over students, and so forth. It is through this paradigmatic learning that the culture reproduces itself. The fundamental paradigm of our culture and science toward nature, which is of quantification and commodification, is learned in this way, though it is being increasingly challenged by paradigms of a higher order, like the vegan and spiritual paradigms of compassion for all beings and the interconnectedness of all life. We are now beginning to see the tension between these paradigms reflected in all our cultural institutions. Kuhn emphasized that theories and findings that challenge the prevailing scientific paradigms typically come from researchers who are either young or from outside disciplines, and who are thus more free to think outside the conventional paradigmatic boxes. The response from those within the dominant paradigm is first to ignore and deny the new paradigm, and then, if it gets stronger, to ridicule and attack it. Eventually, if the new paradigm continues to gain credence over time, it may overturn and replace the dominant paradigm. With regard to eating, as the pressure continues to build, coming primarily from people who are either young or from outside, home leavers, the dominant paradigm can no longer just ignore the vegan paradigm. Science, a stalwart defender of the dominant herding paradigm, could be a potent tool for unseating it. Openly and fairly applied and publicized, science easily and clearly demonstrates that plant-based diets are far healthier and more sustainable than animal-based diets, and that animals experience a full range of feelings, including physical and psychological anguish when confined and treated cruelly. However, the old paradigm is protected by those who control funding to scientific institutions. Scientific studies tend to, quote, prove conclusions that support the corporate agenda, with corporations now providing massive research funding to universities, and with the government's industry-serving orientation, it is easy for the country's two largest industries, food and medicine, to produce a steady stream of well-publicized articles, books, public relations pieces, and scientific studies, all distracting attention from the role of animal foods in disease etiology or proclaiming that animal foods contain vital nutrients. Behind these two huge industries lurks the banking industry, which has invested billions of dollars to finance the high-tech meat medical complex and requires a reliable and ample flood of demand for both animal foods and for medical treatment. Veganism is profoundly dangerous to both of these and to this economic empire's status quo. There is thus enormous pressure within the research community to resist movement toward the evolution of higher awareness and compassion that is embodied in vegan ideals. Rather than relying on science to validate veganism and our basic herbivore physiology, we may do better by calling attention to universal truths. Animals are undeniably capable of suffering. Our physical bodies are strongly affected by thoughts, feelings, and aspirations, and we cannot reap happiness for ourselves by sowing seeds of misery for others. Nor may we be free while unnaturally enslaving others. We are all connected. These are knowings of the heart, and veganism is, ultimately, a choice to listen to the wisdom in our heart, as it opens to understanding the interconnectedness and essential unity of all life. Deepening our understanding of these truths will give science the guidance it so desperately needs. Einstein was both correct and prescient when he wrote, quote, "It has become appallingly obvious that our technology has exceeded our humanity," end quote. Disconnected from the direct, intuitive knowing of our interconnectedness with others, science can amplify our mental delusion of separateness and bring us quickly to self-destruction. We should by now be aware that conventional science is, in actuality, its own mythology with a set of value-laden underlying assumptions that are taken on faith like any religion, and that it is easily prostituted, as other religions have been, by those with money and influence.